Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Chris Lord. On the show today, I'll be talking art and books with Jane Morris, editor-at-large of the Art newspaper, and John Mitchinson, publisher at Unbound. Plus, we'll be rounding up this month's best new podcast releases to delight your ears with Pete Norton. And of course, we'll have this week's Global Countdown with Fernando Augusto Pacheco to delight your ears too. That's all ahead here on the Monocle Arts Review. So Jane and John, welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. We're going to start by talking about contemporary art before we move on to some books. And first of all, we're going to discuss American artist Martin Puryear. Jane, just first of all, this is a quite important show for Martin here in this country, isn't it? This is looking back over 40 years of his work at Parasol Unit here in London. Just tell us a little bit of background about Martin Puryear.
Okay, so I think he's 76. He's an African-American artist who's very well regarded in the United States, and he's had major exhibitions at the Smithsonian and the Guggenheim and so on, but much, much, much less well known here. And it is interesting that this exhibition is on in a small independent space somewhere between sort of Angel and Shoreditch. So he has got a major work in the current Tate Soul of a Nation show. But if you don't know his work, this is a brilliant opportunity to see it. I think there's 30 major sculptures, mostly made in wood. And I think it's very interesting to see his work at the moment alongside the Soul of a Nation show.
Now, you mentioned there the fact that it's all made from wood. And in fact, one of the key things that Puryear does, it's very much about craft. It's about the making of it. It's about the physicality of actually shaping that wood into the forms that he creates. And it's very difficult to sort of describe that signature form that he has, but it's almost this sort of slouching form somehow, something that almost looks as if it's sort of lolling forward slightly and yet has this sort of very, very corpulent presence in the room, doesn't it?
Yeah, he said himself that he likes his work to sort of stand alone and that his work is very largely abstract. In reality, I think when you see them, some are more abstract than others, and it's quite easy to read different kinds of metaphors, I suppose, into the works. I mean, I suppose the work that's probably the sort of most typical that's in the exhibition is a piece called Big Phrygian. It's a bit like a Smurf hat.
This is what I'm talking about. It's very hard to describe. It sort of slouches forward like a nightcap almost.
Indeed, not to in any way suggest that it is a Smurf hat, although it could be a Smurf hat. It could also be one of those French libertarian caps. You don't know. See it from other angles, it looks maybe like it's a fold of a body part and there's something very fleshly, almost sensual about it. So I think it is possible to read them as abstract or almost entirely representative, and he plays around with that. I also think the craft material thing is really interesting. He was at art school at a time when I think sort of classic minimalism was in fashion. We were very much about metal and very sort of sharp metal edges and so forth. He studied at Yale, amongst other places. He studied at Yale, but he crossed over, just to give him a sort of context, with Fred Sandbach, who makes the sculptures out of string, and Barclay Hendricks, who's completely different and also in Soul of a Nation, who painted semi-realistic portraits of black male sort of men activists. So he's at a very odd time, and he very much carves out his own trajectory, I would say, because I think this use of wood, and particularly his love of craft, was pretty unfashionable when he was studying. In fact, sort of unfashionable now, and yet they're absolutely beautiful. The surfaces are beautiful, amazing curves out of wood. You can see the joins only just. I mean, they're beautifully crafted. He paints them, and you can see that he's painted lots of layers and sanded them back. The surfaces are absolutely gorgeous and the construction is gorgeous.
I mean, you mentioned there the importance of the craft material and the wood and the warmth of that. I wondered, it's 50 years this year from Art of Povera when we first saw those first exhibitions that came out of that. And I wonder, we live in a time where insulation dominates our lots of exhibitions. You know, so many works that we go to see are sort of experiential now. You walk into somewhere, something, it's not about the object, it's about something that you experience and then it's disappeared and lost forever. I wonder if there's a slight, you know, by putting the show on, a slight nostalgia for an era when it was about the object or the materiality of what you were looking at as an artwork. And I wonder if that plays out here.
Maybe. I mean, maybe. Although I've always thought that anybody who loves visual material at some level must like craft. And I don't think these pieces look like craft, by the way, I would say. If anything, though, that's again something that I think he plays with, because you don't know if he's being critical about being an African-American or if he's nostalgic. Because one of the things I think you feel running through and through the gallery is more the kind of whiff of American Gothic, you know, the famous painting. You feel the prairies in this work, I think. You feel the wind blowing through the wheat and through the log cabins. So his work's very ambiguous, and I think that's its great strength.
He also studied some of his carpentry skills and how he worked wood in Sierra Leone, didn't he? I mean, how does that play out, that African dimension of the work?
Well, if anything, I'm not honestly sure. Well, I suppose with some of the sculptures it does, actually. There's some amazing pieces that are made at, one of them is made out of a vine where he's actually left part of the vine intact. And it's pretty much the only one where he does that, because generally everything is very finished. So he's left the kind of twisted vine, and then there's two kind of balls at either end of this vine, which I think does have a reference to African sculpture. But I should also say he studied for quite a long time in Sweden. And I actually think some of his craft and joinery skills really hark back more, to my mind, to the sort of 17th, 18th century traditional clapboard jointed Swedish feel, which also, of course, resonates with East Coast America.
It sounds great to me, Jane. I mean, very briefly, you know, as a retrospective, as a way to sort of encounter this artist, is it a good show?
It's a beautiful show, and it's in a lovely, peaceful space. There's one work out in the garden, so you'll be able to see this without barriers, without lots of people, in natural lighting. So I would strongly recommend you go and see this.
So that's Martin Perrier at Parasol Unit here in London, and continues until the 6th of December. Now, Jane, on to your second choice, Haroon Mirza, who has a show on at the Zabludovich Collection. Mirza is a British sound and installation artist, and this exhibition incorporates architecture, sound, sculpture and film to explore ideas behind coexistence in society. Jane, what exactly does that mean?
I think it means it's very, very contemporary. And this is really quite a change in feel to the exhibition that we've just talked about. He uses sound, very dark, deep, throbbing, loud grating sound. He tends to darken spaces, which in this exhibition all the spaces are darkened, so you have this very dark spaces with this throbbing grating sound, very powerful flashing LED lights, so it's pretty overwhelming as you first step into the space. And then within that there are other videos and works installed in the space. On the first gallery, when you walk in, there's a video about Bjork, and Bjork is talking. She's very young at this point, and she's talking rather poetically, and in fact referencing an Icelandic poet, about what a cathode ray television is, whether it can talk to you or not. It is self-deprecating and funny. She makes some jokes at the end about whether or not you should trust poets. She kind of comes down on perhaps you should trust scientists. But there's also a sort of exhibition panels, which you can sort of see, about Eileen Gray, the modernist designer. There's something going on in all of this, I think, about time and memory and remembrance. Others of the works are much more obviously political and talking about the kind of conflicts and turbulences that are going on now. Does the work coexist? Well, the very one space has actually, he's chosen five other artists, and their videos are installed along with one of his videos in this presentation. He does kind of mute the sound down when the others are on, so there is a sort of coexistence. But it's a pretty intense, confusing experience.
Now, I remember Haroon Mirza's work a few years ago at the Venice Biennale when he had this incredible halo-ish cathode ray thing in the air. And as you kind of entered the space, there was this slowly raising frequency that was a very, very, you know, you could feel it in your ears, and then a flash of light. And it was this sort of extremely isolating experience coming out of, you almost sort of left the Biennale for a second and went into this sort of very, I don't know, raw world of electricity and action and dark kind of interiority. Does it work, this show?
I think it does, actually. I found, I certainly think there's one installation that I thought worked really well, and that's the one, I think it's called 9-11-11-9. It's a series of three videos installed or that he's created. Some of it's found imagery and some of it's things he shot on his iPhone. there is clearly something going on about science and religion and fake and truth and environmental depredation and so on, and the damages that damages done to the body that I think does work well. I think it does work well, actually. There's a final experience at the end where you go into an anechoic chamber. Now, I always think of those because I think of David Bowie and the famous Station to Station album cover. And it does look a bit like that. If you know that cover, you know what I'm talking about. You go into a dark room and it's covered with foam. And you're left in there for 5 minutes and it's almost completely dark. There is a tiny, tiny laser beam at the top. And I think that that's got something to do with the whole Einstein wave particle duality. Although, to be honest, I had to find that out afterwards. I would never have worked that out on my own. But basically, you're sitting in this totally silent experience. And because you've been in this very loud and noisy and quite confusing visually and orally and physically experience, you sit in this chamber. And I thought it would be terrifying, actually. I was a bit worried that I was going to sort of panic and want to escape. In fact, it was incredibly pleasant. And I found myself enjoying thinking about just how still could I sit, so you really couldn't hear very much at all apart from your breathing. So that was a very interesting experience at the end.
It's strange you would go from such a caustic experience of all this sort of banging and what have you, and then suddenly into complete absence. Why do you think you did that?
I think probably just to highlight that contrast between the physicality of particularly, because you said about this powerful sort of audio experience, it goes right the way through the body, the one you were talking about. And some of the sound vibrations in this show have the same effect. You sort of can feel it sort of vibrating through your entire body. I don't think it's the most subtle show. I think it's an interesting show. It's quite the opposite, though, of the Martin Puryear, which is much more contemplative and quiet and an experience that gently builds.
John, just briefly to yourself, you just heard about both of those shows, one of which, you know, extremely isolating, disquieting, overwhelming, the other one very tactile, something you kind of, you know, that's all about the warmth of the material. You know, which to you piques your interest?
Actually, they both sound interesting. I suppose I'm more drawn to the Martin Puryear just because I love craft and I love working with wood. In fact, I'm about to talk about Philip Pullman, whose major hobby is woodwork, and some wonderful wood stuff in the novel.
Well, that's a perfect segue, John. Thank you. Haroon Mirza for A Partnership Society is on at the Zablodovich Collection until the 17th of December. Thank you, Jane, for your art selection today. John, let's talk literature. The big news in publishing this week was the release of the new book by Philip Pullman, La Belle Sauvage, the first in a new trilogy by the author. Pullman is best known for his Dark Materials and this new trilogy, Sandwiches, the Last. This initial story takes place a decade before, and the next two installments will take place 20 years later. John, it seems pretty ambitious. We'll talk about his woodworking in just a moment, but has he pulled this off, do you think?
I think he's pulled it off magnificently. I guess there are, if you're going to quibble at all, he calls it an equal rather than a prequel. As you said, it's Lyra Belacqua, the heroine of Northern Lights and the trilogy, is a small baby, 6-month-old baby. So I guess you know that one of the major kind of jeopardies in the plot is sort of solved for you. You know what happens to Lyra. But the main character in the book is not Lyra. The main character is a wonderful 11-year-old boy called Malcolm Polstead, who works as a pot boy in his parents' pub, the Trout Pub in Godstow, which is a real pub in the real world, in our world, but is also a pub in Pullman's parallel world. And all the things...
Have you been to that pub?
I have indeed been to that pub.
And does it match up with his reporting?
Well, it is, it's like always with Pullman and Pullman's Oxford, it's like passing through a mirror. It's both contemporary and set in the past. It is definitely the descriptions of the peacocks in the garden. They're absolutely there. But the priory, where the nuns live, there's some really good nuns in this story. And, you know, we know that Pullman is often touted as the scourge of organised religion. But he put some good religion characters into this book, the nuns, and some sinister bad ones. It's a really, the general feeling that you have is it's 22 years since Dark Materials was first published, and to be back in that universe and back just in the absolute confidence from the first page of an author writing, I think, probably at the top of his game. He never strains for effect. You know, there aren't any kind of odd sort of passages that don't mean anything. He unravels the narrative, and it's a beautiful story. I mean, without giving too much away, Lyra, the baby, is under threat. We meet, of course, Lord Asriel from the first book. We meet Mrs. Coulter from the previous trilogy. the baby is, in the end, Malcolm has to protect and save Lyra from being kidnapped, and they end up going with another really strong female character who also worked in the pub called Alice, who's sort of slightly foul-mouthed, but full of that kind of energy that... I noticed the other day, he said he didn't like the word feisty, Pullman, because he said it was derived from... I can't remember what the derivation was, but he said it was kind of wrong for his heroines. But she's kick-ass if she's Alice, and that she and Malcolm, they protect the... And they go on this like slightly odyssey. They go down the Thames towards London and stop off at various strange mystical islands where they have adventures. It's, I think somebody said that if the first book was a kind of version of Paradise Lost, this is sort of Spenser's Fairy Queen. That's what I love about Pullman. He aims high and he kind of delivers, but not through kind of showy paragraphs of purple prose, but just through ideas. You know, the whole presentation of a world that has been gradually being taken over, the magisterium, and these sort of sinister operatives who are trying to track down the location of the baby. And
now, I'm curious, you mentioned 22 years ago since His Dark Materials was released. That is a whole generation of readers. Do you think this can now speak to a new generation? Can you bring a new generation to there? Or is this going to be people who went through that world before coming back to it?
I think there'll be a lot of that. There'll be a lot of people whose Dark Materials sold 17.5 million copies. It's amazing worldwide. So I think there will be people coming back to it. But I think you could start with The Book of Dust and not know anything about the other trilogy and find it satisfying and compelling as a novel. I hope that he will gain a whole new legion of readers. I mean, it's important to say about Pullman, he's one of those rare writers. He's not writing for children. It's something that can be enjoyed. I think somebody once said, you know, books by children can be enjoyed by adults. There's no great books that are only enjoyed by children. And I think that's the thing. He makes this story, he makes the characters in it, he makes you care about them, just as you cared about Lyra and Will in the previous book.
I mean, from reading him as much as you have, John, what is it about his craft that can do that, do you think?
I think he understands how to tell a story. I mean, technically, what he's trying to do here is quite difficult. He's trying to keep you interested. As I say, when you know that the major thing that isn't going to happen, like Lyra's not going to die because we know she goes on to, and we know she's going to end up back at Jordan College. So how do you do that and make the story interesting? And how do you remember, I mean, you know, if you're trying to write for an audience for the first time, and he does that very well, but for people who've read the subsequent trilogy, you have to lay the groundwork. And I just think he's just a, I mean, I think the whole, maybe the woodworking is a bit of a clue. He shapes, and you feel he's a very careful writer. Each bit of the narrative and the book itself, it's a lovely thing to have as well, with wonderful woodcuts at the beginning of the chapters. And the whole concept, the imaginative idea of the demon, which is, you know, that each of the characters has an animal. The children's animals can change, but the adults' demons are fixed, which obviously was in the previous trilogy as well. But that is still such a powerful number. There's a really bad character in this book, really evil character, who has a three-legged hyena as his demon. The interaction between the demons and the... All the time with Pullman, you're being forced to think about much bigger subjects. You're being forced to think about the nature of oppression. You're being forced to think about how religion operates. You know, the good and the bad of religion in this book as well. It's a much less to do with religion. There's maybe a bit less of the sort of speculative physics that you got in the last two books of the previous trilogy. But you can see he's setting the idea of dust. The idea, you know, the grisly thought that the Mrs. Coulter is fascinated by the idea of what could you do if you separated a child from its demon, and we know how that Northern Lights and so on. So I think what makes him a really great, probably the premier storyteller of his age, is that he understands how to tell a story without patronising. He understands how to do all the tricks of keeping you paying attention. But at the end of every chapter, you know, there's another dimension that he uses this world to reflect upon the one that we're in, without it ever feeling like it's going to sink under the weight of its metaphorical scheme or that you never. It's beautifully light. I mean, you skid through this book. It's 550 pages. You just skid through it.
Jane, very briefly, you're a Pullman fan?
Yes, and I was just saying that I haven't yet read this book, but I did have little listen to it on the radio because I think Radio 4 was broadcasting it, and I can't wait to read it.
Well, that's La Belle Sauvage, The Book of Dust, Volume 1, out now, of course, by Philip Pullman, published by Penguin Random House Children's and David Fickling Books. A bit of non-fiction to round things up now. In The Butchering Art, Joseph Lister's quest to transform the grisly world of Victorian medicine, written by Lindsay Fitzharris. John, a book about surgery might not immediately appeal to most.
It's another great, I feel I've got two great, in a way it's an adventure story. A true adventure story. Joseph Lister, the book is really his story and how he discovered, with the vital key being the discovery of Pasteur, of bacteria. Pasteur discovered microbes. Lister was able to make the connection between microbial action, bacterial action, and infection. And then through patient, careful kind of experimentation with different substances, came across carbolic acid in 1865. The book is told very much in a sort of a narrative style. It's brilliantly constructed and wonderfully lively. There's a man in the street in Glasgow. His leg is badly broken. Lister uses carbolic acid for the first time, and again, patiently and carefully manages to bring the man through without amputation. And that's the beginning. It's the beginning.
And sort of his leg heals, you mean?
His leg heals. Wow. He walks.
How is it told, John? Is it a sort of reported kind of very factual?
It's wonderfully episodic. You start with an absolutely ghastly scene of an operation in London that. The book really starts in the 1840s when going to hospital cut down your chances of survival. I mean, people
was it,
wouldn't...
Was an even more terrifying experience.
I mean,
itself,
you know, yeah. I think we know famously that Florence Nightingale calculated that you were more likely to die if you went into hospital at the Crimea than if you stayed in the front line. So hospitals were places, because there was no understanding of what germs are. Surgeons were these swaggering, amazingly kind of physically powerful people, because they, you know, it was all about strength. There's an amazing guy called Lister. I might read just one paragraph about his prowess. But they had to work incredibly quickly, tourniquet, sawing bones off in seconds. But they would wear their bloody coats as a sort of, the more bloody the coat, the better the surgeon. Nobody washed anything. The places were sort of suppurating. They stank. And the whole thing was incredibly macho. There's amazing scenes of dissection rooms. The great scene of Berlioz, the composer who was studying to be a medical student, ran out on his first day and felt he was being pursued by death down the road. He was so horrified. But so she tells, in a way, in episodic, quite novelistic way, the story of Lister's life.
And what is the arc of his life? I mean, what does he sort of...
The classic, he's working, apprentice to a surgeon, ends up watching, beginning to use ether, which is making it easier to do the operations because there's not so much screaming. Kind of, you know, these... But what he begins to notice is that there is something happening at the end. The infection is happening afterwards. Once he makes the link with Lister, he realises that the pus, which was seen to be a magical healing substance by everybody else, is in fact sepsis. He remembers a field in Carlisle where there was sewage put across the field and they'd used carbolic acid to stop the smell. And he makes that connection, and that's when he's able to experiment. So now, once he does all this, and he's an incredibly patient, careful scientist, he does all his work, and then suddenly, you know, he presents it to the world, and you'd imagine everybody... But no, it took... I mean, he had to fight and fight and fight. And by the very end of his life, he didn't die until 1912, when he was in his late 80s. He is, of course, has been lauded and won every... But for 20 years, he had to fight and demonstrate and carefully show that and perfect. He mixed it with linseed oil, the carbolic acid, so that it didn't inflame the skin. It, you know, he was a sort of true, in a mad macho world. As I say, the Robert Liston character, there's one amazing bit where he's so fast with the knife, he cuts off three of his assistant's fingers and slashes the coat of one of the audience. The guy whose hand he cut off dies, and the guy dies on the... So the only operation in history with a 300% mortality rate. But that's what Lister was coming from. And he comes across as an incredibly... I mean, we remember him now rather sort of sadly and ironically because of Listerine, which was named after him. But his work, I mean, created that. It created Johnson & Johnson were inspired by him to set up their company making antiseptic plasters. I mean, so he had a huge influence on the history of science, but also on the history of pharmacy as well.
And I suppose as well, you know, the fact that this book is called The Quest to Transform the Grisly World. I mean, essentially what he was doing was kind of reducing the grisliness of it. I mean, in the sense of,
Transformed it.
I mean, cutting the screams out, cutting the kind of macho-ness of it out and making it a bit more clinical.
And that's what makes it fun. It's because it's a story you're rooting for Lister and it takes him a long time, but he does win in the end. Lindsay Fitzharris, who has a wonderful blog called The Chirurgeon's Apprentice, which is full of this kind of... She's collected for the most brilliantly gory stories of early medicine. So all of that research, it's a meticulously researched book, but she's got a real flair. She's a real storyteller. There's a character in the book, Ignaz Semmelweis, who was the first person to really say, we should wash our hands before we do operations. These things called germs really exist. And he ended up in the lunatic asylum and nobody listened to him. Wow. And it's so terrifying when you read it. You think it took so long for this is so obviously what's going on. And Lister, as I say, he's that very calm eye of the storm. He doesn't give up. And in the end, he wins out. It's really entertaining. If you want to know anything about the horrors of 19th century medicine, and I should imagine a lot of people would quite enjoy that, it's worth reading for that alone.
That was The Butcher in Arts, Joseph Lister's Quest to Transform the Grisly World of Victorian Medicine. It's out now and it's published by Alan Lane. Now, before this week's Global Countdown, we've got some podcast picks to add to your download list this month. And recommending them is podcast reviewer Pete Norton, who speaks to Holly Fisher.
Pete Norton, welcome to the Monocle Arts Review.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Now, we've got a few podcasts to talk about today, and we're going to start with a bit of music and a new one called Dissect. Tell us a bit about the premise behind this.
So this podcast it's had two seasons now, and each one has taken a deep dive into a significant work of American hip-hop. So the first season was about Kendrick Lamar's album To Pimp a Butterfly, and the second season has been about Kanye West's album My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, the first album for 2015, the second one from 2010. It's kind of, I think this is a great example of what podcasting can do that radio couldn't, because it's very niche. You know, this would never go out even on One Extra, because it's so in-depth. It's a bit like the kind of, almost a literary analysis of these albums. But for someone who, I mean, I'm not a huge hip-hop fan, but I'm interested in the medium, and this has opened up my ears to both of these albums. It's presented by a young American musicologist called Cole Kushner. They're beautifully produced. There's lots of illustrative clips from the records in them. He's done a lot of research. I think he says about 20 hours of work goes into every episode. The episode's about 25 minutes long. So they're really rich. And I think these are artworks that actually merit this kind of investigation. These are, you know, big, big albums, lots of moving parts, lots of hands and craft have gone into them. They're exploring big issues in terms of Black American identity. So there's a lot to unpack, and this guy is doing it like no one else is.
And so how sort of technical does this get? Would someone who doesn't maybe have a basic musical knowledge be interested in listening to this?
Yeah, I don't think you don't have to have any kind of musical knowledge to get what he's saying. I'm sure people will find things to mock in this, because it's like a kind of, he's got quite a deadpan delivery, Cole, and he will like pass a Kanye West, you know, some sort of lurid Kanye West bar, and this guy will pass it word by word, talking about the metaphors and the context. But it really has, I mean, I can just speak as a listener, it really has opened things for me and given me an insight into ideas that in the course of a song can just flash past you without you realising that they're present there in the work. I'd say you'd need to have an interest in, or at least a curiosity about hip-hop and about these works, but you don't have to be any kind of muso to get into this.
Okay, well, let's hear a bit of that deadpan delivery. This is a clip of Dissect.
Musically, we have a fascinating, entirely strange juxtaposition of a white male indie folk singer from Wisconsin with a black female rapper from New York imitating a British accent. As we'll see, the juxtaposition of otherwise contrasting elements will be employed throughout the entire album, displaying Kanye's talent of directing, of orchestrating, of coalescing a diverse array of musicians and sounds to create something entirely new. Thematically, the fairy tale introduction is a synopsis of the central subject of the album, fame, and Kanye's complex relationship to fame. The tale is based on Roald Dahl's dark, twisted retelling of Cinderella, part of his Revolting Rhymes poems that reinterpret well-known fairy tales, specifically giving them morbid, unexpected endings that contrast with the traditional happily ever after approach.
That was a clip there from the first song on the Kanye West
album.
The second season. So, I mean, he's like pulling sort of literary references there, and you say he does up to 20 hours of research on each of these. Is he just sort of giving pure analytical digest of these songs, or is there, does he give any sort of personal opinion on them as well?
He does a bit. There's one episode in particular that really moved me, where it was just kind of a special drop-in episode he did after Kanye West had this kind of, you know, meltdown last year, where he cancelled a load of concerts and was talking kind of pro-Trump stuff in a slightly, seemed like, fragmentary, kind of going out of his mind way. And, you know, caught a lot of heat for that. And Cole Kushner published an episode. He was at that final concert, I think it was in Sacramento. He essentially stands up for Kanye and says that we deserve to give this man our empathy because he's given us so much, and that there's lots of evidence in his songs that he's, you know, suffering from mental illness and on some kind of medication anyway. He just does this kind of very heartfelt plea for Kanye that felt genuine and, for me, persuasive. I'd kind of gone off Kanye West a bit, and this guy's sort of audio essay within this podcast opened my mind to it again.
And I suppose the other podcast that this is maybe most reminiscent of is Song Exploder, but that's told from the perspective of the people who wrote the songs, whereas this is an outsider analysing the songs. What kind of fresh perspective do you get on the music from having that alternative point of view?
Well, I think it's the fact that no one else, I mean, I don't think Kanye West would be wanting to publish a load of footnotes to his works or to unpack them in this way. So it's kind of interesting. It's almost like an academic perspective on something. And it's like we do that for every other medium, but we don't do it very publicly for music, especially for contemporary music. And like I say, I think this stuff does merit it. There is a lot in there that's very interesting. This makes quite a nice partner piece to Song Exploder. Song Exploder is much easier to get into and pithier and shorter. And this is a bit more of a deep, long read, if you like.
Okay, well, that's Dissect. And that first two seasons are available on iTunes now. Next up, we're going to talk about something from Audible called Where Should We Begin? Tell us about this one.
So this is a season made in collaboration with a very well-known and reputable couples therapist called Esther Perel, who's from Belgium originally, but I think she lives in America now. And each episode of this, it's a three-hour-long therapy session that she's given to a couple with an issue or a series of issues that they want to discuss. A three-hour-long session edited down to 45 minutes with their names and any revealing details redacted. But you're hearing their voices and you're hearing their story. I kind of came to this wondering if it was going to be uncomfortably voyeuristic or whether it would feel exploitative of these people. They've all obviously consented to be part of the series. And it's really something else entirely. It's very... Perel herself is... seems to me like a real master of her craft. She's very perceptive. She asks these amazing questions. She's extremely... someone will say something and she'll show it back to them in what seems like a very revealing way. And she's very empathetic, very sympathetic. And the people that she's... in the spread of this series, there are 10 episodes. And there's a whole variety of different issues that come up in different types of couple. So there's one that I was just listening to on the way down here, which is a couple who'd been married 40 years, very happily, seemingly, raised kids. And it turned out that the husband the whole time had been having a series of affairs. And they begin to unpack that and go into it. It's emotional, but it feels like it feels educative to me as well. It's like these conversations that you don't hear people having about something, about, you know, we all have relationships, we all have sexuality, and we all have problems within those things across the span of our lives. We don't talk about it very much. And this podcast, for me, has definitely been a way of thinking about those things a bit more deeply. And it feels like the perfect use of the medium, because you don't necessarily want to have that on Radio 4 while you're making your dinner with your kids around as well, or anything like that. The fact that you can have this on your headphones, is that feels emancipating.
And how do they treat this? How's the structure? Is it, you know, are you just literally like fly on the wall listening to the whole of this couple's therapy session? Or is there, you know, a bit of thought that goes into it, a bit of narration, a bit of a conclusion at the end?
Yeah, there is. It's quite light touch, so it does feel more or less like you're listening to a session, but obviously it has been edited. I think each episode has a little setup where sometimes they have some phone interview stuff that they kind of bring in at the start, which is basically setting up, introducing the couple and the nature of their issues that they're bringing to the session. But it's by and large, yeah, 45 minutes of listening to people talk about their, investigate their problems, if you like, with this brilliant investigator.
Now, this is from Audible. We should talk about Audible as a platform for podcasting. They do have an interesting way of doing it where they only release it on Audible. It's not available on iTunes, at least not for a while anyway. How do you think this is working for them?
I don't know about the numbers, but it feels like, I think this podcast particularly got a lot of traction and sent a lot of people looking towards Audible. When it was launched perhaps 6 months ago, and it was got a lot of write-ups in the press, and I was certainly keen to listen to it. Went searching on iTunes, didn't find it. I had to go through Audible. I initially thought you'd have to pay for a subscription, but you didn't. You just had to listen to it within the Audible ecosystem. Audible is Amazon's audiobook arm, and they're kind of branching out into original podcast content. So they kept it within their ecosystem for 6 months. Now it's come on, the first season has come onto iTunes and is coming out week by week there, so anyone can listen to this. But the second season is about to launch within Audible again.
Okay, well, Where Should We Begin is available on Audible. Finally, we're going to talk about a new true crime series called Dirty John. Now, do you think we're ever going to see the end of true crime and podcasts? It just seems to really dominate.
No, I don't think we are. I mean, we haven't seen the end of sort of criminal procedurals on television. So I just think it's something that plays to our desire for stories and a certain amount of the macabre. But for sure, podcasting seems to be, you know, most of the big breakout hits of podcasting have involved true crime in one way or another, from Serial through to S-Town recently and now this. So I think it's here to stay, basically. I'm hoping that we'll see. What I'd really like is to have a breakout podcast here that isn't a true crime thing. Which isn't to speak down of Dirty John, which is a very impressive and engaging production. This is made in collaboration between the Los Angeles Times and Wondery. Wondery are a new podcast network that largely funded by 20th Century Fox, I think. So there's instance of sort of big money coming into podcasting now. It tells the story of a Los Angeles-based interior designer, successful interior designer woman, and a man who she met on a over 50s dating website, a man called John Meehan. So this is all a true story. And it turned out that John Meehan was essentially a con artist and a deeply evil and troubled man. And lots of other stuff happened after they got together. It's presented and reported by a Pulitzer-winning journalist called Christopher Goffard. It's got a slightly strange mixture of noir atmosphere, some of the conventions of thriller sort of fiction, and seriously resourced investigative journalism. This also isn't entirely a new thing to podcasting, because Serial did a bit of that, and so did S-Town. But there are people who have complained about this sitting uneasily at the border of those things, and perhaps even exploitatively. Deborah Newell, the woman who was involved in this, has been a very willing participant, and she says that she wanted to participate partly in order to warn other people of the dangers of this kind of predatory male. I'm not sure where I stand with it. It's certainly entertaining and gripping, and it's beautifully produced. It's the storytelling of this is excellent, but I'm not quite sure where I sit with the ethics of it, if you like.
But that's the thing that comes up with a lot of these podcasts, like S-Town. There was a lot of talk about whether they'd exploited the main character in that. How do you think it compares to ones like S-Town and Serial? Do you think that is it told in a slightly different way, or is it done slightly differently?
It's slightly different, but it's definitely of a piece. I mean, this one is an LA production, so, and there is something, I mean, I'm a big fan of all the sort of Raymond Chandler fiction, and there's some of the things that Goffard says in his narration are brilliantly kind of pithy and, you know, menacing LA stuff. So there's a bit of that. It's a slightly more West Coast atmosphere, perhaps, than Serial or S-Town. But largely, it's very similar. There's lots of natty use of music. It's very well scored. There's lots of interviews, and from phone interviews, police 911 calls, more recent interviews with relatives and friends who were affected by this man. So it's a real tapestry of a production. I mean, clearly a lot of resource and effort has gone into this. It isn't just sort of a journalist sitting down with a microphone. It's a big production.
To be honest, his story about having the three cars in the house, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. I called BS on that.
Like, why does a practicing anesthesiologist never seem to have any money? When he leaves the house in his blue surgical scrubs, where does he go all day?
I would try to look him in the eye, and he would try to look away. So that just kind of says something about somebody.
But is there something about John's past he's trying to hide?
I opened the mailbox and there was a letter from a guy from jail. I thought, why is he getting a letter from someone from jail?
Pete Norton there discussing his podcast picks. Now, it wouldn't be the Monocle Arts Review, would it, without a selection of songs from our man, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Where are you taking us this week?
We are going to Italy. And,
Italy.
It's such a shame because I looked at Jay now and I see there's no rock and roll in the top five. I'm so sorry. But there's a lot of Italian rap if you guys are interested.
Italian rap, we'd love it.
The main story here is actually the battle between old school Italian rap and the new generation of rappers. Both are represented in the top five, which I'll tell you the top five right
What's
now.
In at number five, Fernando?
Number five is Pink, What About Us. I don't think we should waste too much time talking about it because, you know, she's being
neither
everywhere.
Neither Italian nor rap.
Yeah. Number four, more reggaeton. It's J Balvin and Willie William. So this Colombian singer is doing very well. The song's called Mi Gente. And again, Italians do like this kind of music, this kind of usually Latin songs do very well.
Fernando, what strikes me though is every time I've done the Monocle Arch review and you're here, we always get onto the subject of reggaeton. It just amazes me how far this type of music, I mean, even infiltrating the, you know, battling world of the Italian top charts.
No, absolutely. And it's such an influential genre that even in Brazil, we have some sort of country music, which is, you know, it's not connected to reggaeton at all. But even country singers, they're changing the way they sing because of reggaeton. You know, it is an impressive story, you know, and I think Colombia, Costa Rica, you know, Puerto Rico as well, they do very well with this genre. I'm sure it's doing very good for their economies.
What's in at number three, Fernando?
Number three, so yeah, I was talking about the old school Italian rap scene, and we have one of them called Ghe Pequeno. I don't know if you guys have seen City of God, the Brazilian film.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the main character is actually called Zé Pequeno. So it was kind of a little tribute to this character.
So is this being re-released then, Fernando? Are these sort of the old greats being brought back into the charts?
When I say old school, you know, he's still actually launching new material. So, and this time the song is called Lamborghini. I didn't actually read the lyrics, but there was a huge Lamborghini in the video clip. And it felt to me very kind of gangster rap. You know, I'm singing my Lamborghini and, you know, old school fun. It's a fun track.
And then in number two,
we have rap, but this time from the US. It's Post Malone and 21 Savage with Rockstar. I spoke about this before. Post Malone, even though he's a rapper, a very young rapper, he does mix other genres like country music and, you know, even reggae. It's quite a cool song and I think he's doing well.
And he's Italian as well, is he?
No, Post Malone is American.
He's American.
But number one is Italian. Shall we hear a clip?
Sure.
I want to see your opinions on it. That was Italian, you know, I say rapper, but you know, it can be a pop song, you know.
It's
his name is Coes, La Musica non c'è. Sorry for my Italian, which there is no music translating. So, you know, it's a bit more melodic. It's not as, you know, as like Ghe Pequeno and his Lamborghini. And, you know, it does feel quite romantic, but it still is part of this new generation of Italian rappers. I was even chatting with our colleague Chiara. I don't think she's a huge fan, even though she's Italian herself, not a huge fan of the Italian rap scene.
She doesn't strike me as a massive Italian rap fan. No. So are these older guys, are they, I mean, look, he's in at number three, Ghe Pequeno. Are they managing to sort of hold their own with a new generation, or is this sort of older buyers picking up the records and seeing what he's doing now?
That's a good question, actually, Chris. And I forgot to mention, actually, Ghe Pequeno's song, he does have a featuring there and is a young rapper. So, you know, they do need this kind of this new generation to update his Sfera e Basta. You know, he does do some little rap in between. People love featuring those days, don't they?
We take you everywhere here in the Monocle Arch Review, don't we? And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks very much to my guests, Jane Morris and John Mitchinson. This show is produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and I'm Chris Lord. To play us out, let's have some more of that number one straight from Italy. This is La Musica Non C'è. Thanks very much for listening and goodbye.